power of our diplomacy. Diplomacy.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a really big deal.
The strength of our diplomacy.
Oh, that's a really good point.
Yeah.
One. Deadline.
Welcome to another episode of Diplomacy Cast, everybody.
Hey, how's it going?
Episode 20.
Is it 20?
It's a big round number.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, we don't care. 18. That's what we care about.
I mean, when I solo, it's usually 20, but...
Usually 20, yeah.
That's true.
Did I ever tell you about that? No, never mind. In today's episode, we have stuff.
We do have a couple of things.
Yeah, we have a big meaty, meat and potatoes-y power plays, because we keep promising we're going to do more of that strategy stuff.
Yeah, and we've been avoiding this one.
Yeah, yeah. The vaguely unpleasant subject of stalemate lines.
But almost, it'll be interesting.
Vaguely unpleasant, but incredibly useful
right.
Subject of some is stalemate lines. And how you can use them to abuse your opponents mercilessly.
Like, yeah. Fun.
We're also going to have a brief hot off the press segment, and our guest today will be new editor of the Diplomatic Pouch, Chris Babcock, our new friend of the show. If you have any questions, any feedback, any thoughts, any dreams you want to share with us,
or if you're just feeling lonely,
press at diplomacycast.com.
Still works.
Yep. Yeah, we check it from time to time.
we check that thing.
Yeah.
We do.
Yes. We also have a Facebook.
Yep.
And you should subscribe to us on iTunes if you have not already, and leave us feedback and stuff, because that is cool. All right. Show. Hot off the press coming up after this.
Hot off the press. Yeah, people don't use a press anymore.
Drop it like it's hot.
Oh, so if we just dropped it like it was hot?
If we just dropped it like it was hot, you can do better than that.
Drop it like it's hot.
Off the press.
I'm not saying that.
Okay, cool.
It's hot off the press.
Hot off the press noises right here.
No, yeah, well.
Let's go over the brief emails that we have.
I have a cold off the not press. Nobody cares that I want to play an online game. We have received exactly zero emails about on the subject of persuading, the name of the diplomacy game, persuading me to play some particular non-random online game in some venue. So you.
I'm shocked, for one.
Yeah.
I really thought you were going to be mobbed.
You liked this idea.
I think it's a great idea.
Oh. So,
I mean, I never said it was going to be a successful idea.
No, it's apparently not going to be a successful idea. So,
we'll give him another week.
Well, yeah, you guys got to however long this takes. Shout out to me. I need ideas. I want to know what I should do in terms of playing an online game, or else I'm just not going to play one. It's fine.
Well, we're ready to throw down the gauntlet.
Yeah, no, whatever. But, okay. I actually only have two emails that I want to read today, because we do have a giant subject coming up here. One of them is just a follow-up to something we did in the last episode. James wrote us that amazing story about his online game where the French guy was like, move to the English Channel in Wales, it'll be awesome, and we'll be allies. And Nathan particularly found it very entertaining.
Yes, it was pretty good.
And requested a follow-up, and we did indeed get a follow-up here. He writes, hey guys, thanks for reading my email. Here's the rest of the England game. I did take the French up on their offer, so he went ahead and took the French suggestion.
As you do.
Right. Germany reacted quickly and tried to apologize to Russia with less than limited success. Remember, Germany also didn't tell anybody.
Yeah, that's what I thought. It was hilarious. Like, they're in the channel and all of Germany turns east.
Yeah. Because Germany had apparently no idea what was going to happen. Russia was very interested in one or two German centers, but was abruptly distracted in the southeastern situation. This is about 1903, and Austria and Turkey had gone against Italy, but now they turned their attention north. Okay. At this point, I was so very happy. Germany was losing centers. France was also having a say in the Italian conflict, and we were both growing. Then, after a long while, France got the courage to politely ask my fleet to move out of the channel. So far, I had gotten away with leaving it in there, as I almost always had a fleet in the North Sea, preventing it from moving east. Wait a minute. With leaving it there, as I almost always had a fleet in the North Sea. Oh, preventing. I see what he's saying. He's saying there was just nowhere for the channel to go. Well, that's when you go to the Mid-Atlantic, and sure. We're sailing around, give you an extra fleet, but no. And it had a job comping my armies onto Germany. Fair enough. I decided to move out of the channel right after infiltrating French lands. It is not lying, it's delayed compliance. Sure. Germany was still alive, so I decided I would let Russia take the last one or two centers on the grounds that he not move against me. He agreed, so I began to organize my attack. I convinced France to go for the last Italian center and the surrounds, which made him move his fleet south, exactly what I wanted. Not sure I followed that, but I broke into Burgundy. I was in excellent position. France's fleets were in the West Med and
I'm the Mediterranean. Yeah, here.
And Russia was focusing elsewhere. It didn't take too long to clean up France, especially after getting Austria to trust Turkey and use France's earlier attempts on the Italian home centers as a motivation for revenge. I was strong with about 12 centers. So with France gone, it was pretty much between Austria, Russia, and I. Turkey was still alive, but all over the place in no strong position. So I gladly pointed out to him that Austria was his best way forward, which it was. And he was the reason I soloed. Ah, there you go. It was a solo. All right. He distracted Austria, which allowed me to secure a few more centers south, and Russia and I battled in the north. Luckily for me, Turkey either didn't come to his senses and work with the other two, or was indifferent to my winning. I sneaked three centers against Russia, and the others came in from Austria. All in all, it shows how a game can be dominated by the right diplomatic standings. I believe my win was due to A, France's opening proposition, B, France getting convinced to overextend south, C, Turkey working, quote, with, unquote, or at least not against me. I'm glad you guys found the 1901 of this game as hilarious as I did.
Yeah, I certainly thought it was funny.
Yeah, I like his last point the best out of all of that. We talk a ton about how 1901, like, something weird happening in 1901 will sometimes just paint the entire game. Like, it just does. Sometimes
1901, I would say.
There's, like, the randomization of drawing a power out of a hat, and then there's also the randomization of just if something strange happens early on in the game. It can change a whole game, and sometimes you could just walk over and look at the board and just be like, oh, wow, what happened?
I don't know how it's going to end, but it's not going to end well for that guy.
Yeah, yeah, and so that's something, I guess, that's something you sort of can generally take away from this. Pay attention to something out of the ordinary happening early on in a game, and try and make predictions based on that. It'll just help you judge a board generally.
I don't know where you're going with this, but I think you're underscoring our previous points that we've done a number of times.
Yeah.
It really makes a big difference.
Yeah.
When you do something wonky, or, you know, you have a player that does something that's atypical or any of those things, it can really have a profound impact on the game. And that particular offer in conjunction with Germany moving east, that painted that. I was waiting the way I was waiting for the ball to drop, like he'd somehow screwed it up, but
no, you know, he soloed
just like you think.
He fully soloed, yeah. And that, the turkey being ticked off part is significant, also, of course, you know. Keep the little guys on the other side of the board fighting. That's the way to solo, one way, but we've covered that at great length. So thanks, GG.
GG.
WTG.
James.
James. No, yeah, James. I'm already on to the next email.
Oh, here, sorry.
All right. The other one I wanted to read, this just is one of those things that made me very happy. Russ, his name's Russ Dennis. He writes, Eric and Nathan, thanks for the great job you do on Diplomacy Cast. That's all. No, there's more. I've been listening.
We get a million of those.
Beating them away with the stick. I've been listening to you guys for the last year and really enjoy it. In my last email to my group, I sent out a link to your website. Yeah. Oh,
correct.
What's this group, you may ask? I started Iowa Diplomacy a few years ago because I want to play face-to-face rather than the email versions I've been playing for years. There is currently over 30 diplomacy players that strive to gather one Saturday a month to become the leader of Europe in central Iowa. It's a very eclectic group. We have people with backgrounds in postal diplomacy, play by email, and tournaments. The greatest feat of our club, though, has been introducing new players to the hobby. Yeah.
I like Russ.
Yeah, totally. I like that Russ is in Iowa because we have way too little in the Midwest these days. And so that's awesome. I wanted to go ahead and give you contact info for our next event. If you want to plug it on your show, it would be great. Our show will be out by then for sure. I'd also be more than willing to talk about starting a group in smaller areas. Jim O'Kelly might have hit it on it all, though. Thanks, though. Shameless plug for interview. They're called Iowa Diplomacy Meetup. Their next event is Saturday, December 8th.
You gotta work on your enunciation.
I really do. And it's at Mayhem Games in Des Moines, Iowa.
Centrally located.
He says Google and most GPS read their addresses wrong because Des Moines has strange roads. He sent us a map, but I'm not going to read that. You guys can do it. Call him. Call Mayhem Games in Des Moines if you need to figure out. 1 o'clock p.m. till 9 o'clock p.m. Good. Plenty of time for it. I'm curious to know how many boards these events are getting. I mean, it's... If you're getting two or three boards like on a regular basis, that's great information for the rest of us to know. Yeah. You know, because that means you're there, and that means the strange, mysterious people are going to come out of the woodwork and try and convince you guys to start coming to tournaments and build your own and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, whatever.
I don't think it's that close. I think it's a couple states away. Iowa, yeah, because there's Ohio that has.
What's the thing they got there?
Not Gen Con.
Yeah, well, the thing that happens at Gen Con, that's right. Their event.
I mean, there's Buckeye Game Fest.
Yep. But for whatever reason, it's sort of geographically isolated from the rest of tournament diplomacy. It's like, true. We don't get that many travelers from around there.
Yeah, it's hard. Well, it might be anyway.
But wow.
Yeah, nice job, Russ.
There you go. Yeah, definitely. So
nice job.
There's that shout out. Okay, we're done. Power plays.
Power plays.
Power plays.
Power plays.
Power plays.
Okay. Guessing most people know what a stalemate line is. But just in case.
I really hope so.
I didn't always. So, just in case, that there are a bunch of positions on the board where you can keep somebody who's trying to advance from advancing any further. Like, there are just combinations of pieces and provinces where it doesn't matter what they order, there's no guess involved, and they can't move any further, and they can't hurt you any worse.
Right.
These are stalemate positions. A game might frequently end in a stalemate, in that nobody can win the game. Nobody can solo, and so you have to call it a stalemate. Draws happen for other reasons,
sure.
But that's, you know, if you were to play a game out, it would either end in a stalemate or a win, always, right?
That's sort of the definition.
Or people taking their board and going home. But yeah, I guess if you were to play a game and that was out of the question.
I mean, I like to think of them as locations on the board where you can have a configuration of pieces.
Yeah.
You can set down a series of orders and walk away and know that no matter what, however many years they play, your position is not going to change.
Yep.
There's nothing they can do to in any way impact those orders. That's kind of what I think of this stalemate.
I've literally done that at tournaments before.
Yeah.
It's just like me and another guy wrote a combination of orders and went to the tournament director and said, we're going to go get barbecue. These are the orders until the other guy accepts it and accepts the draw. We'll take nothing but a three-way draw. Goodbye.
Have a great day. That's really pleasing to be able to do.
Yeah.
That's definitely one of those things, if you're ever able to do it, that you cling on to that one. A little badge of honor for that.
Yeah, because sometimes they're hard to make.
They're not easy.
They're easy to screw up.
They're very easy.
It's easy to think that you have a stalemate when you don't have a stalemate.
There's also, a lot of mythos about it. A lot of tribal knowledge. People know that there are stalemate lines there, and they look at a position and they start trying to tell you either you don't have a stalemate line or you do have a stalemate line.
Yeah.
And if you don't really, really know, it's easy to get duped.
Yeah.
So it's easy to get overconfident.
Yep.
Confident.
Well, now who needs the enunciation lessons? Knave.
Knave. So how do we want to, like, How do we want to go through this? I think
First of all, the disclaimer. The disclaimer is we're not just going to sit here and read you different stalemate lines.
Yeah, we're not going to even. We're going to tell you where they're at.
We're gonna talk about a few of the important ones, a few of the ones that we feel actually come in handy, and we want to include a lot of talking about how you use them diplomatically.
Yeah.
Because the stalemate lines sort of philosophically are a negative, cranky, poopy part of the game that it's not fun to just be like trying to stop somebody else from winning.
And it's not fun getting stopped.
And it's not fun getting stopped. Right, exactly. Like, nobody likes stalemates. The threat of... They're sort of like Senate filibusters. Like, yeah. Nobody actually wants to do it, but everybody knows that maybe the other guy can, and it kind of makes you change what you do to try and get what you're trying to accomplish. Sure. Accomplished. And so the threat of them diplomatically is probably as important as knowing them. Knowing them is going to save your butt every once in a while. And of course, an important distinction, which we'll get into further, is that if you're playing an online game, you can just look them up.
Yeah.
Right? If you're playing a face-to-face game, you actually kind of have to memorize them, or else I guess you could bring a book of stalemates.
But I've never seen anyone do that. Yeah. I guess you could,
That's true, but you don't have time.
You don't really have time.
Yeah. So typically in the tournament world, people memorize them or think that they've memorized them or right. don't memorize them and occasionally cost themselves a game by not memorizing them.
Which is only mostly awful.
Right. we have the experience of sort of like both feeling like we used to know them better and it was helping our games more back when we like used to pay more attention to it. And it's come up, definitely. Because almost every game, there's at least the threat of it at some point. At some point, you have to just go.
Which is why we want to make sure everybody knows about it, because you're going to get in situations where people are going to be talking stalemates at you, and you need to be ready for that.
Yep. So I guess the first thing is there's a couple of main kinds of them. The biggest distinction that I would make between different kinds of stalemates is there's the ones where you... gets the ones that stop somebody at 17 or fewer.
Yeah.
And the ones that stop somebody at 18 or more. Now you might say that's not a stalemate, but
right. No, it depends on your definition.
Yeah. No, the ones that stop somebody at 18 or more obviously aren't for stopping a single person. They're for stopping combinations of powers. There's relatively few where you stop somebody at like 17, 16, 15, so something short of winning, like true stalemates.
Right.
There's quite a few more if you're trying to stop, say, a England-France alliance that's coming at you. You can bulwark up and they can have 21 between them. And as long as you have the other 13, and so on. So that's an important distinction. The basic ones are the most important ones. The stopping somebody at 17 or fewer ones are the most important ones.
The 17 one, I think, is the one everyone tries or thinks they know.
Yeah, or a couple of different 17 ones. That right. are,
we're talking mostly about this sort of St. Pete to Spain.
Okay, we can start with that. Actually, before we even do that,
all right,
let's take the listener to where we went and looked at all this stuff while we were prepping for the show.
True enough.
And it ties in nicely to our guest who's going to be joining us later. It's at the Diplomatic Pouch, which is diplom.org. You can actually hear me typing in the background.
Right. That's good.
It's very interactive.
And I will say this is the same place I went to originally learn these things.
Yeah, me too. This is I thought of this.
This is the same resource for the last
these articles haven't changed
15 years.
15, 20 years. It's a little hard to find, and if you guys haven't found this resource, it will blow you away. It's going to like really help your game. So from diplom.org, you go to, where do you go? Online resources in the top right corner. Good stuff. Then you wait because Nathan's internet sucks. Just saying.
Yeah, it can't be your computer.
No, Nathan's internet. Probably Nathan's internet.
Sure. Once you get there.
What? Because yours is working. That's cool.
You hit stalemates A to Y.
Oh yeah, there's a player reference thing on the left of that screen, and then stalemates A to Y. There it is. There's a whole ton of articles here, and they're all basically using the same images that are just pictures and descriptions of the different stalemates. So we relied heavily on this, and both as players and in the prep in this episode. It's as good as, I mean, I'm sure there's a million other places that you can go look at this stuff, but this is the one I knew, and so we went right to it.
It's good. It's good stuff. I mean, if you don't have it, you should try and read pretty much everything that's in here.
Yeah,
the visual index to stalemate positions is a great place to start, because you can just sort of look at it and get kind of ground yourself as to what it is you're looking to do.
Yep.
So yeah, that's where we're at now.
So what Nathan was talking about it as the east versus west thing.
Well, I want to call it the basic stalemate line. Like,
yeah,
this is the one you, if you learn nothing else, know this one.
Yeah, well, okay, it's a little different depending on whether you're the east or the west, but it's the same 17 centers on each side. excuse me. The 17 centers, obviously, or maybe not obviously, I don't know. If you're trying to defend the west, you're trying to defend England, France, Germany, and then
Iberia.
Spain, Portugal, Holland, Belgium, Denmark, Scandinavia,
and St. Petersburg.
Right. Those are the 17. And in the east, the opposite: Russia, Turkey, Italy, Austria, Balkans,
Tunis.
Yep. 17. So I don't know. Do we describe exactly how you do
it? I don't think it's probably not where they do it, but it's
all there.
It's all there, and this is the kind of the baseline.
Mm-hmm.
You need to understand how this line works,
mm-hmm,
and what it looks like with the units on the board ish.
Yep.
There's a little bit of flexibility in it, but more or less, get to know. Set it up on a board at home if you need to.
Yep.
If you can't get it out of the diplomatic pouch because they don't really put units on it, get to know what this looks like and play with the pieces a little bit so that you understand the dynamic there. Because so many people talk about this as, oh, it's locked, oh, it's not locked.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a little bit piece, you know, it's unit heavy in the center.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of get an idea of how many units we're actually talking about that need to be on that border between, you know, the Austrian hinterlands and Germany.
Yep. If you're, I guess maybe we could talk about a couple of critical points in it.
Sure.
If you're trying to defend, let's see, if you're the east and you're trying to defend, what are some important spots on the board that you need to be looking at?
Well, obviously, there's your same, and this is going to be for east and west. There's, let's just start mid-Atlantic and western.
Yep.
So that whole Spanish sort of block,
yep,
there, know how to do that. That's, and we're going to come back to that one later. That's a good one to know. It's also very easy to memorize. So it's a nice place to start. So that point is critical.
If you're the east, they can get through. They can get past the Mid-Atlantic. They can get to the Western Mediterranean and, mm-hmm, and North Africa. There are ways of defending if they've gotten that far without losing anything else.
Yep.
If you're the west in that area, you really can't lose Mid-Atlantic.
No.
I don't think.
Not
off the top of my head. In the center,
Tyrolia.
Yeah, so there's all those ones that are sort of surrounding Munich and Berlin.
Tyrolia, Silesia.
Depending on exactly how it's arranged, those center lands can change hands, you know.
Yeah.
But you can't, well, obviously you can't lose Munich or Kiel if you're the west, or else it's over. Or Berlin if you're the west, or else it's over. If you're the east, you can lose some of Eastern Germany and still not lose, like, Warsaw.
Yeah.
Which would make it over. It becomes more difficult if the West has managed to put an army in St. Petersburg instead of a fleet, because obviously it can threaten Moscow and Livonia. That's important, too. So that's sort of the north. If you're the West, St. Petersburg is really easy to defend.
Yeah.
Because You always assume in these ones that if Russia's lost St. Petersburg, Russia's also lost his ability to build northern fleets, and he doesn't have a northern fleet anymore. It gets a little tricky if he does.
Yeah, if there's a weird Russian fleet floating around, like
it'll ruin everything.
It makes things a lot tougher.
Or say an angry German fleet.
Yeah,
if you're
trying to set up a stalemate line, you want no hostile fleets up there in the Baltic Sea and in the Gulf of Bothnia. You just keep them out. Just go out of your way to destroy them, because you're gonna find that it's not impossible. It's just a lot more difficult to do it if there's somebody bouncing around.
Well, it's impossible to make a stalemate if there's an enemy fleet sailing around the north. It really is.
Not if they're trapped in Livonia, you can do it. It's just awkward.
That's true. That's true. Yeah, you can be in Livonia, but not any further.
Let's take that as the thing.
That's the one that we
have to know. And it's one of the few 17. There's just a couple.
Now there's different variants that sort of exchange different centers for each other.
Yeah.
Like the East can lose.
You can do like a Tunis Munich swap, or
right. The East could have Scandinavia and St. Pete. But not, and like Denmark or something, but not most of Italy.
Yeah.
And you can find a 17-17 there. So there's that's where all these variants come in, where you're holding people at a different 17 than the ones you might expect, but they just don't come up as often because just of the nature of the way that the game usually plays out.
Right. But, well, it's largely because is what Eric just described. There's such a bottleneck at Gibraltar there, and such a bottleneck on getting fleets up north for the east that just doesn't come up as much.
Yep. Yep.
You're gonna see the threat of this stalemate line in almost every single game.
Right.
So that's why
if you know no other stalemate lines, figure out how to hold 17 from each side, assuming that everybody has their own side.
Right. Not just for you. There. Because not just for you, obviously, and probably implicit, but let's be explicit. If you're the only person that can really do it quickly and you can see it, then you're the person building the coalition to stop the person from soloing.
Correct.
If somebody needs to have that skill at the table.
Or alternatively, if you're the guy trying to solo and you suddenly recognize that none of your opponents know how to do this,
right?
You have a huge, huge, huge advantage. Like, or better yet, if you can trick them into thinking they don't know, which is something that happens all the time in these games. People will sit and be like, look, you're stopped. You're not going any further, so you should do this blah, blah, blah thing that we want you to do. And then the other guy goes, no, I'm not stopped because you can't hold Galatia here. And this sort of bickering happens all the time. Be on the right side. Like, have the facts. Be on the right side of that argument because, you know, or else intentionally be on the wrong side of that argument.
Or just say, oh, shucks, you got me. Let's just play one more. And
exactly.
Hey, whatever you need to do.
Exactly.
But know this line. We'll stop harping on that one.
Yep. Some other variants that will kick in of this line the West gets more of Russia in exchange for, it's sort of the North at this point, not really the West anymore, but like what we'd say you have the West plus like Warsaw, Moscow.
Yeah.
And there's sort of a more solid line there, but then the East has like Marseille, Spain to make up for it, or I forget, Marseille, Spain.
So you sort of move into more of a North-South configuration.
Yeah, and as long as we're talking about just 17-17 splits, then I guess we have to trade one for one, and there's a few ways to trade one for one without screwing it up. There's also, the reason I make that distinction is, I mentioned earlier, there's also a ton of ways of holding less than 17 centers.
Oh, yeah, scats.
In a bunch of places around the board. Like you could have lost all of Russia and be backed up to, like, where the East just has, you know, like, Sevastopol, Austria, Italy, which isn't close to 17, but if you're trying to stop two powers, that's totally useful. There's one other 17-17 line that I'm sort of easing into there by mentioning those other lines that is one that I've made a few times. It's a little different, but The time that I found that it comes up is if you're either a Russia-Austria or Russia-Turkey, and you're trying to do like a north-south split.
Right.
There is actually a way to do that.
Yeah, you can actually play that alliance out to a 17-17.
Like, yeah, if you want it, you could have a forced 17-17 stalemate where, like, Turkey or Austria has their home and then the other guy also, you know. Yeah. Like, Russia has what you'd kind of expect he has, including England and northern France, but not very much in the south.
Yeah.
And there's a 17-17 that way, and it's worth mentioning because if for whatever reason that's your goal, like a two-way, or at least you want to play as if that's your goal for a while,
sure,
that is an achievable goal. It doesn't usually happen when there's like one power in the west, one power in the east. It could be like a England-Turkey
draw. Could have it
conceivably. Great. It could be England-Turkey. I guess it could be Germany-Turkey. But that split, or it could obviously be any of those powers and then two other guys on the other side for a three-way. This is not something you can do with, say, England-France.
No.
If you're pretending that you're playing for an England-France 17-17 two-way,
that's not gonna work.
Your ally has been tricked by you.
Hopefully. Hopefully that's the way it's going.
If he thinks that, that, or he's tricked you. Exactly. Because if he thinks that, no, we can just like make this forced 17-17 where we can't hurt each other and we get a two-way, somebody's getting sold a bill of goods there. Because there's no such thing in the West. There's no such thing where like you can start in the West and like split up half the board in any logical way that's ever really going to happen.
No.
So that's worth mentioning also. But there's a 17-17 north-south line that's basically like the south is Turkey, Austria, Italy, southern France, Tunis. The north is everything else. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty significant line that you might want to familiarize yourself with. We are just bad at talking tonight.
Familiar. Yeah, good job. No, I'm impressed. Yeah. I'm impressed. Yeah. No, so we've covered east-west, north-south.
Yep. And again, we're doing this from the standpoint of a couple of tournament guys that actually have to like apply this in the heat of battle. Like,
right.
So if it sounds general, the specifics are right where I took you to on that website. You can see all, 55 different stalemates that anyone's ever found. There you go. Ranging from holding four centers all the way to holding 17 centers. Well, a lot more, I guess.
Yes. 17.
Yeah, holding four to holding the other 29, I guess, if you wanted to look at the other 30, if you wanted to.
Yeah, there's something like that 29 center stalemate line. Whatever. That's a pretty good one.
For two people. I mean, it'd suck to be like 15-15 with your ally and be like, oh, we're stopped.
Oh,
drag.
I think there's. I'm more fascinated a little bit with like the witches who both have their own
stalemates. So right. The thing that I was getting at there was that there's other ones that are smaller non-17-17 ones that we find come up a lot, and so we wanted to mention them specifically. Yeah. The ones around Turkey
Are problematic.
Yeah, there's a lot of people I think that Turkey can just turtle up and be invulnerable in like a corner with like the Aegean and the East Med and Greece, or maybe in Bulgaria and his own centers, or like something, like they think that there's something completely secure that you can build down there where you can't be taken out at six centers. Myth.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in their defense, it is incredible. It is inconvenient.
It's extremely inconvenient. No argument there.
But it is true that they're not invulnerable. And I think that, and players have gone on and discovered that there's a Turkish stalemate line. And
there is.
And they haven't bothered to look into what it is. And so they get somewhere around six or seven centers.
Yeah. The smallest stalemate line that is, like, holding that corner of the board that I was able to find in here, and I'm pretty sure this is just a rule of thumb, is 13.
Yeah.
There is a way, if you have the 13 that you would expect that you have in that corner, that nobody can go any further. But that's a pretty big number. Turkey, it involves Austria, it involves
Sevastopol.
Part of Italy. There's variants of it where you have Sevastopol, there's variants of it where you don't. Yeah.
But the the rule is, it's always 13.
Yeah.
And so another quick little lesson you can have is if Turkey is saying, or some coalition making up Turkey is saying they have it locked down and they have less than 13 senators,
they're
wrong.
Yeah, I'm looking at these now. They all have all of Turkey. They all have all of Italy. They all have... they don't have to have Tunis. They don't have to have Vienna. They don't have to have Sev, but they have to have one of those.
Yep.
Or probably two, and all three is best.
Just think about that.
Yeah.
13 centers, all of Italy.
All of Austria.
That's a trick.
Yeah, that's big. Tunis, there's one with Tunis, one without. There's one with Vienna, one without. There's one with Sev, one without. But the rest of that adds to 13. So that's all Turkey, all the Balkans, most or all of Austria, all of Italy, so maybe Tunis, maybe Sevastopol.
So that's what you need to be looking at when you yourself are trying to set up that stalemate line or thinking that you've really got somebody blocked.
Or you and another guy.
If you're trying
to make some sad-ass four-way draw on or whatever.
You maybe need to kill some time while other people fight.
Yep.
So
you can learn those ones and you can actually lock them up. Just have 13 when you're doing it. More's great, but they'll eventually push you back to 13. Yep. That's how the stalemate thing works. It's like there's a lot of these lines that'll have a lot more in them, but eventually if you just sit there and brawl for hours and hours and hours, you end up at the line that you were thinking of in the first place. And I guess that's an important distinction to make. Okay, and then the last set of them that we wanted to sort of address by name and number are like the North ones.
Yeah.
Ones
you should know.
Yeah, the ones that we find ever really come up in games.
Right. Mostly the Turkey one does not come up very often. It gets mentioned a lot, but it doesn't really get played.
People don't make it very often.
Yeah, it's really hard to do. And that's what, I mean, we're mentioning it because it's mostly myth and legend.
Yeah, we're mentioning it because a lot of times people will threaten you that they have the Southeast locked down and you're never getting any further, and they're frequently lying.
Right. In contrast.
Or else they really think that, but they're wrong.
The Northern one comes up constantly because it's very, very easy.
Well, I don't know that I played it that much, but go on.
No, I'm just saying, like,
you can do with you about this.
No,
I'll pick my battles.
Pick your battles.
Yeah.
The locking the Mediterranean, locking the Mid-Atlantic, the Atlantic Ocean, that comes up all the time. You can do it with three pieces. Four pieces.
Yeah, it's a really weird one. It assumes that nobody has anything in the North except you, and it won't come up.
That bit of it, knowing how to do that and having the mental, like, just the peace of mind, knowing that if you have those units, that's stoppered up down there, and you can focus the rest of the units on something else.
These Northern ones are basically... they're the same as just the big West one that we already talked about, except you've lost a bunch of France and Germany.
Yep.
And obviously, again, if you've lost it to one person, you've lost the game. So you haven't. You've lost it to two people at this point. Like, you're trying to stop an RT or something. And there's a bunch of ways to huddle in, like, Scandinavia, Denmark, Belgium, Holland, and then down to, like, Brest, Mid-Atlantic, maybe Portugal, even Spain. There's a lot of different ways to do that, to hold back the East if you've lost a bunch of the center. It's still okay to lose a bunch of the center. And they go, there's a lot of different sizes of them. The biggest, I guess I'm looking right now, has you holding like Portugal, Mid-Atlantic, and then into France, like Burgundy, Ruhr, Kiel, Denmark, Scandinavia, St. Pete. That's a pretty big line right there. But then there's, like, you could start losing. If you didn't manage to get that before you started building a stalemate, there's actually ways of, you know, doing, like, just Portugal, Holland, Scandinavia that way.
Yeah, I think that one comes up, that 8-center one. And those are basically the two big anchors of
this.
Knowing how to do the St. Petersburg lockdown, knowing how to do the Atlantic Ocean lockdown, and just kind of whatever you can get out of the center in a tangible, in a lockable way, that those two anchors are really what you need to focus on.
Yeah, Portugal is sort of a very stalemate-y space because it only borders two other things, which is, like, pretty weird for a space on the diplomacy board to only border two other spaces. Yeah. And so, for obvious reasons, that one's kind of easy to hold.
Yeah.
I feel like there's even one where you don't have to... Yeah, there is. Well, no, maybe not. Where you don't have to have St. Pete, but I could be wrong about that. Like, where you could stop them at Norway. Like, they can't ever get out of St. Pete if you're in, like, Norway and Norwegian, but maybe Norway, I'm Barents just doing Norwegian. That. Yeah, Norway, Barents, Norwegian, but hey, I don't want to be wrong on that.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess maybe the problem with it is you assume that Russia can build, and if you can build, you can build fleets, and then you're screwed.
Unless you have some, like, I'm just going to be in Gulf of Bothnia with my fleet.
Well,
and Barents.
Gulf of Bothnia is cool. Underrated space. After Spring 01.
Yeah, because if you don't have St. Petersburg and he's pumping fleets into, you know, under Germany there, it's not gonna go well for
right,
you.
Right, okay, so that was the first and sort of probably driest part where we just talk about, like, some lines we like.
And that's this is mostly context.
Yes.
And, you know, pointing towards what you should know and what we think comes up a lot.
So then the next thing I guess I wanted to talk about was...
I didn't want to talk about it.
Well...
Maybe we could both want to
talk about it. I'm going to say it, and then we'll both say how we feel about it at the same time. Ready? No, just kidding. Here's the thing that I wanted to talk about. God, now you got me all psyched out. This is awesome. do you really need to memorize them? That's my question.
I don't think you need to memorize them.
Okay. Like, walking around with all 55...
You don't need that.
I'll say this about it. If you did know them all, you'd actually probably be a much better player.
Hmm. Oh, yeah, no, I don't disagree with that. It would be great. I just don't think that you're going to... the amount of time it would take to memorize them...
Well, right, but it can be... Well,
and there's so many...
First of all, this is something that's totally different for face-to-face and online, we should say. Like, if you're online, of course you don't need to memorize
them. Yeah, no, you're those bastards up.
Dangerously insane if you do. If you're at a tournament working on really tight deadlines, like you are at a tournament or at a house game, having that information at your fingertips, well, how would you use it? Let's say you did.
Well, I think, the way you're framing it is not how I would say you're ideally using this information.
Mm-hmm.
I think what you need, what's helpful is to read about them, explore them, have set them up once or twice, the more important ones, especially the ones we've highlighted, so that you get a mental map of what it looks like, what a stalemate looks like, and then you can start applying that sort of thing. And then you're going to have to massage it a couple of times, and because it's not just memorizing the provinces and the units that specifically have to be in them.
Right.
It's also what orders, what supports. If it's a dynamic stalemate line, what orders do you have to move to cut a support? Like, you have to memorize all of that.
Right.
And I don't know if that's really going to be that helpful to you. It's going to be. If you understand the mechanics of it, you can do some of that just on the fly.
Yep, that's true.
I don't disagree. It's an advantage, though.
Awareness of them, I guess, it lets you start making a sort of intermediate to long-term plan at a certain point in the game. It once sort of the early game is over, you're kind of a couple of powers are eliminated or close to eliminated, you've sort of identified who the big threats on the board are. If you're on offense and you've identified yourself as the big threat, then knowing where they're likely to try and get to stop you is really important knowledge, because then you can try and beat them there.
If you know where the line is and you can beat them across.
Yeah, if they don't quite realize yet just how dangerous you are in the position that you are, then you can start getting to a point where they can't set up a stalemate before they even know they're supposed to set up a stalemate, or before they're able to get organized to set up a stalemate.
And to be frank, if you know it enough ahead of time, you can make moves that might not be in your usual style. Mm-hmm. Say you're a very methodical player, you like to to move forward, take your center, solidify, move forward, take your center, solidify.
Right.
If you know that they're in a, that they haven't locked it up, and you can sneak two or three units across that line,
yep,
it's worth it to just to abandon centers before you even keep them.
Oh, yeah.
To push across.
Absolutely.
To know that, I mean, that 17-17 one, you hear about that all the time. I'm across the line. But the same thing, same goes for any of the other stalemate lines that we've described.
Absolutely. I mean, we've said before, we've talked before when we've talked about, like, planning your solo to kind of, if you've got it at, like, a lot of times, you know, at this point in the game, you'll still have a good ally.
Yeah.
And you'll be doing well. And you're counting to 18 in your head when you're looking at the board, and you're usually counting your good allies' centers in there. Like, I'll give you a more practical example, because that might have been too abstract. If you're running a Russia-Turkey alliance, for example, you're Russia, like, you guys are kicking butt, you've killed Austria, you basically killed Italy, the Turkey's starting to work on France, you're in Russia and you're all the way into Germany and bashing through that way. If you get some of those big ones on the other side of the line, like if you're through Germany and like working on England and stuff, then when you're counting to the 18, even if Turkey owns, you know, three Balkan, two Austrian, and two Italian, you're starting to add some of those to your 18. Like,
right.
You might be at 9, but you're looking at those Turkish centers going, well, when I stab Turkey, I'm going to get these Balkan ones, I'm going to get his home centers, I'm going to get this. And knowing that at that point the jig is up and the rest of the board is probably trying to organize against you, you know you're probably going to get pulled back because it's harder to hold those English ones that you've got.
Yeah.
You're probably not going to get to keep all those. If you do, you're mazel tov. Then you've got a great, you know, you're going to have a 22-center victory or whatever, but you're probably not. Like, you're probably going to be trying to hold the stuff over the line as you try and gain the easier stuff on your side of the line. So the further you can get across any stalemate line that they could conceivably organize, the better chance you have to solo.
Yeah.
And knowing where those stalemate points are, where they could, if they push you back behind this, you're done advancing in that area. That's pretty important knowledge. And of course, now on the flip side of that, if you're not the guy that you've identified as the dangerous power on the board, if it's somebody else, then you need to start going toward those spots that you know are the dangerous spots that he can't be over.
Right.
And you need to start working on the other people on the board to start making the stalemate while they still can.
Right, and this now, is what we were mentioning earlier.
This is where it gets into the diplomacy part.
Right, you want to know where these lines are, because you want to make damn sure at least you know how to construct a stalemate line and put your forced allies into regimented lines and making sure they're in the right place and making sure they have a resource they can go to at the last second. And go, wait, I'm not sure what to do. What do I do?
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that.
We are going to get to
that.
But there's just it's important to
we
have.
We can get to that now, but there's a point I want to make too.
Oh well. Let's just make your point.
I'm very magnanimous.
Let's go chronologically.
My point was, a lot of times you're gonna just be in your trenches on your side of the board, just, you know, bashing at the, you know, like, oh, Russia and Austria are fighting Turkey. Now Turkey and Austria are fighting Russia. Now blah, 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 blah. At some point, something can happen on the other side of the board or somewhere on the board that all of a sudden turns something into a solo threat. And right or wrong, you need to be able to persuasively make the argument to a guy who's been fighting you the entire game that if you guys don't stop fighting right now, England's going to solo this game. And here's why. We don't hold this, we don't hold this, we don't hold this. He's way over this line. We have to start pushing him back. We have to start working together. It's a diplomatic thing that you can use when you're right, and it's a diplomatic thing you can use when you're wrong if the guy you're talking to doesn't know any better.
Yeah, that's true.
I say that because I can remember a lot of times when I was newer to the game that I got fooled into stopping attacking people that I should have continued attacking because they'd come to me and they'd go, dude, the stalemate line, we have to, your piece can't be attacking me from Bulgaria. You've got to be all the way up in Galicia to stop this wild runaway German. What are you doing? Why do you keep fighting me? And they're not doing that because they're really worried about the German. They're doing that because it's something to make my pieces go away from them. And if they sound smart about it, if they sound like they know something about stalemate lines that I don't, then a lot of times I get fooled by that.
Right. Which is why, which just goes, it dovetails well with what I was saying earlier. Yeah. Like, you need to know enough that you're not going to get, it's not distracting to you, but you need to know enough to know when to move.
Yeah.
So be the guy that has, be the guy that has those tools.
Yeah.
And that's really what this whole episode is all about. But what I'm interested in is what we're going to talk about next.
Oh.
This is the stuff that I'm interested in.
You like the coalition organizing stuff.
Well, no, I do like that. But the next bit for me, and then you can pull me back if this is too far you know, down your imaginary agenda that we work so hard putting together.
but I have an abstract. I have an outline. I have a syllabus. I have a curriculum vitae.
I'm interested in the use of stalemate lines in diplomacy as before they materialize as sort of a weapon and as sort of a
the threat, the mutual assured destruction part of
right.
it.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the stuff for me for stalemate lines that's really the most fun. Like if you have a really a decent working knowledge of these things,
mm-hmm.
you can persuasively describe the stalemate line that you have, even if it's not quite there yet. And start using that as, there's no point in wasting your time fighting me. I'm not quite there yet, but in one move, I'll be able to lock this down, and you guys can do nothing. Even better, you actually have the stalemate line, and you have it locked down. I'm also interested in, you know, describing for you folks what you should be doing with that, with that situation, because game ain't over yet.
Because that's the fun part. Because sometimes just the first time of the board reaches something that starts to resemble a stalemate doesn't mean the game's over.
No.
Not even
I think
close.
A lot of people do that. Like they've worked so hard on this project, coalition building project of making this stalemate line.
And they end up with like 5-way draws.
And they do, but they've spent so much time on it. They're so invested. It's like the bridge over the river Kwai.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, yes, I've done it. Okay, I've accomplished my goal.
Right.
So we're done. No, you're not done. Now.
Yeah, that's the starting point. Now, hey, okay, Russia, Turkey, you're not going any further. Now, Russia, would you like to consider stabbing Turkey? I will help you, and this will be good for me.
And the trick is to do this dance somehow in which you are trying to maybe align with the other side and do something, yet balance that against the coalition that you're barely holding together that sees you talking with somebody from the other side.
Yes.
So that
happens every game almost.
It is such a great trick, and it is one of the most rewarding, and it's the incarnate of diplomacy. If you want an example of what happens, it's that. You are two-facedly going, okay, we're going to hold it. Hey, we're going to screw them. At the exact same time.
Yep. And nobody knows who's right, and you might not even know who's right at that point. Like, it's just whoever gives you a better deal is who you're going to stick.
You can
stick with the stalemate guys that are offering you the 5-way draw. The safe 5-way draw, or you can throw in with one of the aggressors on the other side. You know, like Russia and Turkey are coming. Ah, screw it, I'm working with Russia. You know, I'm not doing this because I think he's going to stab. And that's actually something like that the emotion will come into it sometimes. Like because parts of the game get grindy and stalematey, and nobody's talking and nobody's having fun. All they're doing is they're trying to build their little line. A lot of times, if there's somebody on the other side of the board who I've been fighting, and he's willing to just stab.
Yeah.
Just to not do it anymore. And it makes the game fun again. Yeah. Like, I'm willing to risk a solo here. Like, I'll throw in just because that's fun. And that's going to make this game not a 5-way draw, which is what it was going to be if everybody just decided to stick to their guns. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. There's the part, there's a few parts, I'd say almost every game, where there's one coalition and another coalition, and they're not talking much across the thing.
Yeah.
And then can be like one, two, three turns in a row where you've got like one guy from your coalition and one guy from the other coalition are together talking. Like, come on, just stop this. It's over. It's a stalemate. Break it up. And they do what they know. But that's it. Really is sort of a like. I get why you like it now, because it's like the walking on hot coals of diplomacy. It's like the endurance test of diplomacy. Like just to like sort of like grind somebody into like the guy in Glengarry Glen Ross who's just like okay, I'll just buy it. Just please, just stop.
Just stop. I can't. Just go away.
Yeah, exactly.
No, that's what I like. That
you like. Breaking a man.
Well, that isn't quite how I would. I like.
But you kind of
do. A little bit.
Yeah.
It's what I guess. What's so appealing about it is, you know, you have this project with this other person. Yeah. Let's just assume it's two. You know, EFRT.
Yeah.
And this happens not. It's not too uncommon.
Yeah.
And the EFRT sort of meets in the middle.
Yeah.
And you're usually on that St. Petersburg, Spain line.
In some form.
In some form or another. And you've just been in it for so long and you're so close to winning.
Especially if it's like 2-on-2 like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're so close. Like, it's just like it's you and your buddy versus him and his buddy.
And you're like, and you've never broken.
Yeah.
You know, and you hit and there's no way to change this dynamic.
I kick the West's ass, you kick the East's ass.
Yeah, we're in it and you hit that line. It's a part of the game in which it's where the talking kind of stops in a way, like you were describing, but it stops in a way like it doesn't matter what I say anymore because there's a physical barrier that is stopping us from going in further.
Right.
And that's the only way that you can have a dynamic change.
You are.
That's why I like it.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you are talking, but you're just talking with your buddy the entire time about, like, okay, so you're supporting me into Bulgaria.
Yeah.
Okay, you're doing
it. And just, the whole time going, no, we got this.
Yeah. No, they can't hold this. Yeah, exactly. And breaking up that dynamic is a really big thing.
Right. It's nearly impossible to do. Yeah, if you want to break with your ally and work the other side,
yeah,
good luck.
As soon as you break, it's going to cause this like chain reaction that's going to lead to soloing, or at least that's what everybody believes at this point in the game. It's not usually as true as people believe it is, although.
Although
I
having lived through it,
I mean, I can think of like these like 2-on-2 situations where I was the one who caved. Yeah. I was like, all right, fine, I'll stab my ally. It'll be fun, and then I die.
So we're doing a 3-way then. Great.
Yeah, exactly. With everyone but Eric. Like, and sometimes that'll actually like that'll make people mad. Like, I've had things where like the biggest power stabs his ally. And then suddenly everybody else gets this, like, esprit de corps that's like, screw that guy, we're going to take him out. I don't care if he's the biggest power, and I don't care if it takes all night. He's screwing it up for everyone. And
he was
and
just like, mean.
We're taking Turkey's last center. Yeah, exactly.
It's even good for me. I'm still going to punish you.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to find you down
so know your people.
Syria.
Yeah, yeah.
Have a nice day.
Yeah, and they do. Or they don't. You know, they think they're going to for a while, and then they get bored doing that. It's too hard, and someone else says, but point is, the game can change when you think there's a stalemate. That's a very long way of saying the game can change.
Right, and that's what's important about them. Like, you know, there's a lot of people, like we said at the beginning of this episode, you know, stalemate's almost a dirty word.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh gosh, I don't really like it, blah, blah, blah. I know plenty of players that lament them, like they're like as if they're a broken part of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it shouldn't be like that. It really hobbles the game dynamics. But I will say, maybe the game's just evolved this way, but there's really these points at which you can change the course of a game.
Definitely.
In a way that just would not be possible without them.
I don't like when people start talking about them too soon. I don't hate the things themselves.
It's 03 and we're talking about stalemate lines?
Yeah. That's a way to sort of, like, in a diplomatic way, like, really turn me off. Like, just, like, make me lose interest in doing something. When a guy's trying to convince me that I should be the good ally to him because we've got to get to Bohemia before this happens or else we're doomed. Like,
it would happen in an aggressive Western triple.
Sure. Which I don't really like Western triples either, so maybe there's something there. I think it's sort of a pessimistic way to play the game, and I think people are sometimes too quick.
Oh yeah.
To go for the stalemate when there's not really the solo danger that they're making out there to be, you know, or runaway coalition danger that they're making out. Like, the game's changed so much turn to turn, and you know, I get that sometimes you're playing with fire by not making a stalemate that you should be making, and instead just trying to, like, kill somebody on your side of the board or something. But that's just more of a taste thing for me.
Well, you're, like, touching on something that's important to be, and we haven't really explicitly mentioned this. There is a phenomenon that will happen that Eric is hinting at. You can move too early and cause a rush to the stalemate, which will almost always end up with, you know, 2-3-way alliances. Either Austria, Italy, or Turkey is out. Maybe Russia's out. One of the East is out, and you got, you know, these. It's 1904, 1905, and now you have these two triples staring each other down a wall, down a line, because one side went too early and the other side panicked and reacted.
Yeah.
It craps the game out.
One that immediately occurs to me is if there's that early Austria, Italy, Russia alliance, and they're like, let's just take out Turkey because he smells funny, and
they just go all the stuff back here.
And they just go and they do that, and then all of a sudden they're like, oh well, there was just 4 centers down there that we didn't already have, you know. And then instead of two of them stabbing the other one, the AIR says, oh well, that was fun. Let's keep it going. And then all of a sudden, like, one turn, bang, Prussia, Silesia, Bohemia, Tyrolia, like Gulf of Lyon, like all this stuff just like comes like pouring over at once. And then all of a sudden the whole West goes, holy crap, we have to stop attacking Germany. We have to stop doing everything we're doing. And then the next thing you know, like, you've built like this version of the 1717 lines, but with like 6 people still on the board. And you go, what the hell just happened here? And
sometimes it's just, there's too many powers on the board, and they have like 5-6 units each, and it's just not enough to really kind of do that go your own way that I was just talking about when there's only 4. Yeah. It makes it much harder, and it tends to crap the game out.
Yeah, it does. And it just sort of adds an extra hour in the middle while everybody is neatly, tidily building their stalemate line in the middle before somebody inevitably stabs somebody.
Yeah.
And it's fine when they do. Like, it's not that big a deal, because there's still, like, not anybody who has more than 7.
Right.
You know? And so, like, even if you break your line and they come spilling over and get to 10, and there's still enough other people who can react to the fact that somebody gets to 10 without it being like a huge thing. So, yeah,
rush to the stalemate, it can happen when they just go too early, and there's no need for it.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. It wastes about an hour and a half, depending on the turn time. So somebody's like, well, let's do this a couple more times, and then let's see who's brave enough to jump in the water. Yep. Okay.
Check everyone's breath, see who smells the worst, stab that guy, continue playing.
It's something that exists.
But that also actually touches on one other thing that we also touched on a little earlier and didn't actually get to, the, like, coalition organizing thing.
Yeah. Which I do like. You are right. I do.
Yeah, it's fun. Nathan likes being it too, but like writing everyone's orders for them is why he likes that so much.
I do enjoy that a lot. Yeah. outpost way in like Liverpool.
Yeah, get writing all the orders for the troops on the front.
Some like crazy general on the mount. Yeah. No, we got this.
Yeah. You just need to be in Bohemia. Like, you're in Liverpool. Yeah, but you need to be in Bohemia. This is an important dynamic of the game, especially in face-to-face, like more in face-to-face. In online, you usually kind of have time to work it out. In face-to-face, if there's one of you and 3 of them, you automatically have a giant advantage. Because the 3 of them actually have to get all of their orders and supports right, and they're on 3 separate sheets of paper, and they only have 15 minutes to do it. And all 3 of them have 3 different ideas about what the best move is there, and they spend a bunch of time bickering about it, unless
they have a general.
Unless they have a clear-eyed mounted Nathan Barnes to guide them in their
Shut
time
up.
Of
trial. Your idea is wrong.
Yes.
Do it this way.
And I, to be perfectly honest, I'm very happy to have a general.
Whatever. Oh, yeah.
I'll be the general if I have to be the general, but, like, my tendency is usually to try the zany.
Yeah.
And like, oh, well, they probably don't see this coming. And sometimes it's awesome, but sometimes it's stupid. Yeah. And so I just assume somebody who, like, really loves building stalemates, I'd let them be the general.
It's also, it's way more efficient because the problem you're describing is a huge problem. When you have three different people doing three different things, and they all, I mean, just communicate about
especially
it.
Especially, like, if it's four and one guy has one piece, but he's in. Like, that guy's a nightmare.
Yeah.
Just like, what did you write?
Tyrolia.
Yeah,
you know, exactly. He's in Galatia.
You absolutely need, no, what you're doing is you're supporting the Russian fleet from blah, 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 to blah, blah, blah. And he's like, yeah, okay, whatever. And writes it wrong half the time. It's like, it's really bad. And
it's a
lot of times stalemates that should exist can't exist because of this problem. So if you're on the little side, the side that's trying to stop the stalemate, like, find your general.
Yeah, like, it's better.
Be the general if you feel really confident about it. If you think there's someone better, just write what he says. Yeah. And get the other guy to write what he says too. You know, like that's your job at that point. It's just, you know, like, live or die with that guy's ideas about how to build the stalemate line. If you're the guy who's trying to break a stalemate that someone else is trying to build, waste their time. Waste as much of their time as you possibly can. Ask them about their families. Do anything to just, like, because they need every one of those 15 minutes probably to make sure that their orders are right. And if you can just go, Nathan, I just want to talk to you for 30 seconds. Like, hey, would you consider stabbing this guy if I supported you into this, 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 and this? Like, so whatever ridiculous
idea.
It doesn't matter. Do it
legitimately enough that they'll allow you to continue to interrupt you.
Right.
Like, you want to make sure, interrupt them. You want to make sure that you're not just clearly pestering them.
Yeah, because eventually they'll just start saying no if you're too big a jerk about it.
Yeah.
So do it in a polite way. Just say, look, I think you guys might have me stopped here. I get that you're building the stalemate line. I still think there's a thing that I can do, but if you have me stopped, we should talk in a couple of years about maybe cutting Italy out of this.
And don't do it all. Like, maybe just go through a rotation where you do one a year or something where it's not...
Because
you really only want to waste about 3 or 4 minutes.
Right.
You don't want to waste all 15. They're not going to allow you to do that.
Right.
But if you could have cut out 2-3 minutes, that could be decisive.
Yep. So somebody's going to, like, support Munich to hold when they were supposed to support Munich to Silesia, and all of a sudden you got Munich and you won.
Whoops!
Yeah.
So it's definitely something you want to know how to do and know how to disrupt.
And honestly, there's a slightly more less cynical reason for doing that also, which is when everybody's organizing a coalition against you, you actually sometimes do need a plan B. If they stop you for soloing, let's cut out Italy or, you know, whatever. Like, actually could have legitimate things to be talking to them about. You don't have to just be a total...
Yeah, I mean, you could think of it as a less, I'm actually building for future plan B stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, like, if I do get stopped here, then stuff, but as an added bonus, sometimes they screw up their orders every solo when you're doing that.
Be aware of that when you're on that coalition. And find a general if you can, or find some other way to smooth out that harried communication with, you know,
because it's bad, especially if there's two people who think they know what they're doing and they totally disagree on whether a move is okay or not. Like, because then you spend,
half the time just
eight minutes bickering about, like, whether it's better to attack Westmed or Gothelion, and the next thing you know, you're like, we seriously have no orders for this whole half of the board here. Now what are we going to do?
Yeah. It's worse when there's a fundamental disagreement because you spend so much time trying to figure out what it is you're going to talk about.
So we sort of transitioned in a way that I think is kind of natural, but from the actual stalemate lines to the stalemate lines that you sort of have to be planning for and trying to build when the time comes to build them. And that's an important point in this, I think. Like, the actual stalemate lines that look just like they look in the little picture you're going to look at on the website don't necessarily show up all that often, or at least until the game's, like, really, really genuinely over. They don't necessarily show up. People spend a lot of time trying to make them, or being aware that they're going to need to make them at multiple points throughout the game. And that's the sort of the second tier of this. You know, yes, know your stalemate lines, know where they are, know how to build them, but know when you have to.
Right.
And know what you need to do to get to the point where they can be built, and use that diplomatically. That is just as big a part, if not a bigger part of it.
Well, like, the corollary to that is to know when someone else is moving. Like, things that seem that aren't necessarily threatening to you, but you can see one or two moves out, like, oh, wow, that guy is going to be in a place where he's going to be across the line, or he's going to be substantially on it. It's the same. It works both ways.
Yeah.
Which goes back to our fundamental lesson. Watch the whole board.
Watch the whole board. When you're France and that Russian guy just spilled into Berlin, that's something that sort of has implications. Like, even if you're France and you're fighting Italy and you're not even thinking about it, like, all of a sudden, like, you might have to stop and go,
how far is he? What kind of resistance is there?
Yeah.
Is Germany going to crumble like the Third Reich? I don't know.
Maybe I need to change my plan here. Yeah. So being aware of what those dangerous places are, that there's kind of like no point and no return.
Yeah.
Yeah. Know that sooner than later. But, you know, there is, I guess, one optimistic thing that I'll say about stalemates is there is a sort of like job well done element to when you really actually do create a genuine stalemate. Like,
well,
the one where you put your orders in the box, go eat your lunch, and come back and your opponent is still sitting there with this like helpless look in his eyes because he knows he's got 17 and he can never get 18.
Right.
That's pretty cool.
Like, and so it's coming back from lunch. Oh, you still at it?
Yeah.
No, I know you don't believe me. Locked.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, really locked, because they just sit there and they just try and try and try. One important thing, don't ever be the guy with 17 who gets convinced that you're locked when you're not actually locked. Like, be the guy who sits there while everybody else goes to lunch so you can make absolutely sure you can't break the stalemate, because it's like, oh, I don't know. It's like in poker when you fold the best hand and there's a giant pot or something. It's just like, oh, you'll never forgive yourself for it. Like, you'll get home, you'll wake up in the middle of the night and you'll just go, hang on, I could have got Warsaw, and you'll never sleep again.
Or, like, if your so-called friends on opponents are real jerks, they'll wait till you call it and then go, well, why didn't you just do this?
They will.
Yeah.
This was a lock.
I really just...
Why'd you call the draw? I
definitely do.
Why'd you call the draw? This was a locked look. You could have just done this and this.
Oh, thank God you didn't see that.
Yeah. And
so, definitely don't. I don't want to mock the people that spend a couple extra turns really probing that stalemate line.
Yeah.
You got to be sure, because it's not worth it.
Yeah,
you got nowhere else to be. Just make sure.
Yeah, for sure. Final thoughts. We're done. I think with everything on my little note sheet.
Yeah, good. I feel good. I feel good about it. Oh, you know what? I was going to talk about, and it's going to take us off on a little bit of a tangent.
Go ahead.
There are some centers. There's some spaces that you should really just be aware of. I think we kind of mentioned them.
Yeah.
Portugal.
Yeah.
Norway. Ukraine. Galicia.
Yeah.
I mean, just like, know
Munich,
those spaces.
Berlin.
Yeah. Know those spaces. Like, there's some really key spaces that you'll see
the
vast
one that
majority.
Falls to make 18, basically. It's well, I mean, they're the obvious ones, you know. Spain, Marseille, Munich, Berlin, Warsaw from the other way.
Right. But I think what I want to get at is, if you're looking to build a stalemate line, or people are claiming a stalemate line, and it doesn't involve Portugal, it doesn't involve St. Petersburg, or it doesn't involve like Ukraine, or probably Galicia, like, they're not necessarily the most important centers ever, but if they're more important for their lack. If they're not there and they don't. You can see that conceivably they're not going to get them.
Yeah.
Know that there's probably something wrong with the stalemate line.
The sort of spill through spaces,
right.
In other words. Yeah, Ionian for certain lines.
Sure.
When once that's gone, you just go, uh-oh.
Yeah. Oh, that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
So just kind of, yeah, and we're not going to go through all of it. But they become pretty obvious.
Go to the website, look at the maps, and look at the ones that recur again and again and again.
And it's those spaces you keep seeing them. So just be aware when they're when a line does not have them, and you'll know. It's just like that good. Gotta have 13 for Turkey. Like, it's just a good rule of thumb.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I guess we'll find out now whether our friend Chris Babcock has any opinions whatsoever about stalemate lines, or if he just wants to talk about the pouch.
Hey, either way.
I'm cool either way.
We can't plug it enough. It's a great site. It's been around
for years. Ask him what his favorite stalemate line is.
Oh, it's going to be excellent.
That's the worst question you could be asked.
What's your favorite? Oh, well, that would be the...
I like position 17.
The Bohemian Panicker.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. No.
Whatever it is. No.
There's no such thing. Okay, we're done. Interview coming up next.
Out.
Joining us now on the show from Phoenix, Arizona, Chris Babcock, who is doing something awesome for the hobby. And when people do awesome things for the hobby, we have them on the show. That's our new
That's the rule we just made up.
Made up. Chris Babcock, new editor of the Diplomatic Pouch, diplom.org on the internet. Welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you.
It's, we're doing the Skype thing, so it might be a little bit of a delay. Just, we'll just roll with it.
Yeah.
It's going to be good.
We got Skype to cell phone to transmitter to satellite phone back to Skype. It's fine. It's totally fine.
But like we said earlier, we relied a lot on the Diplomatic Pouch for the stalemate discussion we just had. And
yep.
It really got us thinking we should really talk to Chris and really flesh out what it is we are using. Because I know I've used the Diplomatic Pouch, as I know we mentioned, going on 15 years now. And it's such an amazing. There's so much stuff on there, and hopefully we'll get the chance to kind of give everybody an overview.
So for people who don't know what it is or have never used it before, do you want to kind of give us the basics, Chris?
Okay, the pouch is a zine, which is published up to 5 times a year, and I say up to 5 times a year because the last time it was published 5 times was 2007.
Yep.
Oh. That's honestly,
about right.
But it's been going since 1995, and as a result of just being there for so long and having such awesome contributors over the years, there is just a wealth of information that is stored in a surprisingly accessible format.
Yep.
Unlike a lot of zines, it has a very good sense to publish each article as an individual page. Which makes it really friendly for Google.
it's really easy to find things. You can honestly type in a question. You know, Google lets you search by site if you want to ever do this, and you can just search the diplom.org and like just ask a specific question, and the likeliness that you're going to find the answer to your question is pretty good.
So it's sort of an accumulation of. All kinds of knowledge. Articles, for one thing. One very important thing. Just all kinds of strategy and tactics and all that sort of stuff. What other kind of stuff is on there?
A lot of color pieces. We had Larry Peary gave us 4 or 5 articles for the fall 1912 retreat issue that was published at the end of October.
Okay.
And he's like... You know, what was happening in the news 50 years ago? What is a diplomatic pouch? How does an old guy like me have any success in diplomacy?
Yeah. Or does he?
Oh, Larry Peary. I haven't seen him. I have not seen him since 2005.
Yeah, yeah. He's still around, though. He's probably got a bajillion articles in here. So how did you get involved with it?
Well, I was filling in as an editor for the started out with being an associate editor for the email section where I run the judges. And then I filled in for the online section for a fellow that had health problems and wasn't in there, so I was on the mailing list. And then around the end of last year, Manus was bemoaning the fate of the dip of the pouch since there hadn't been an article published in almost 2 years.
Manus Hand, the former editor, right?
And founder.
Right, well, the founder, the originator, the man.
Okay. So he was whining about the fact that nobody else is writing articles now that he doesn't do it anymore, which makes sense.
Yes, exactly. And Charles Roburn, who does an excellent job in getting articles from a Word format, text format, whatever happens to be thrown at me, getting those in HTML and getting them online, he was saying, I would love to be able to do it, but I just don't have the time to be able to chase articles down. I just haven't been able to get articles.
Yeah.
And somebody else said, well, the hobby is so siloed, and you've got your face-to-face crowd, you've got your judge crowd, you've got your play-by-play email crowd that won't touch judge with the 10-foot pole, and then when you start to get into the web-based educators, you've got the web diplomacy people who aren't talking to the play diplomacy .com right. people, and you have a whole bunch of other groups that are lesser well known, like Droid Dippy, Dip 2000, Play Diplomacy Online.com, not to be confused with PlayDiplomacy.com, and very few of these people are talking to each other or doing anything together. And if you want to have a successful zine and get a lot of articles from the hobby as a whole, and not just from face-to-face, not just from the judges, then you really need to have somebody who has his finger in all those different pies. And somebody, I think it was David Norman, says that there just isn't anybody like that in the hobby anymore.
No, not so much.
And I said, you didn't just say that. Because even though I spend most of my own time running a judge based on the end judge, I'm also, I can't play on my own judge because that would be cheating.
Sure.
So I've got to play for myself. Most of the time I play on Postal. Obsidian, a magazine out of England. I actually get a hard copy about every 5 or 6 weeks, to me from England. And my daughter thinks that's a trip.
Yeah,
I bet.
We think that's a That's awesome.
And it's wonderful. And it's wonderful because with a 5-week deadline, I can do just about everything that I want to in my real life.
Yep.
And not worry at all about keeping up with the diplomacy, keeping up with the schedule.
Yep.
And it's really good for me.
Okay, so you do most of your playing Postal. You have some face-to-face experience, we have to ask, because we're sort of a face-to-face show.
Yeah, well, I am trying my darndest to get a face-to-face group going here in Phoenix.
Excellent.
A couple of years ago, I went to a convention, Random Con. It was held over Mother's Day weekend, and my wife was thrilled with that.
I'm sure.
I bet.
And I did get an exhibition game going. We went about 4 years into a game with 7 people, and I was pretty happy with that. As far as regular players, people who will actually come out specifically for a game of diplomacy, I've got 4 so far.
Okay.
Well, you're about halfway there.
Yeah.
A little bit over halfway there. It would be really nice if I could get them all to show up at the same time at the same place.
Because then you'd have that 4 people hanging out saying, I wish we had 3 more people.
Yeah. Oh, well, I have a map of 100 in my box, in my diplomacy box.
Oh, okay.
That's a free player version, and I'm happy enough, playing the judge.
Sure.
I do administrative stuff all day long anyway, so it doesn't bother me not to play.
So you run sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. You run the USAK judge, right?
Right.
That's a lot of work, huh?
Well, it depends. Running a judge doesn't have to be a lot of work, but I make it a full-time job simply because I love it so much.
Yeah.
And what I've done that makes USAK so special is I put a web wrapper on it.
Oh, okay.
So for people who want to play on a play-by-email judge, it looks and acts and it is a play-by-email judge, and everything works just fine that way still. I didn't break it. but I went ahead and put a web interface on it. And for the people who say, oh, learning to use a judge is so hard, I say, no, it isn't. You register, same as you'd register for any website. I've even hooked it in so that Facebook will fill in most of your registration if you happen to have a Facebook profile.
Wow.
And then once you're registered, you go to a form in the upper right-hand corner of the page, any page on the site. You type in your email address and the password you want to use. Click sign on. And then there's a list of forming games. And next to forming games, you click on join. And it'll take you to an order form. If you want to add preference list, you have to read the guide then. But if you just want to join a game, you click send and you're done.
All right. And are there quite a few games running at a time?
Yeah, I'm usually running about 100 games at a time.
Really?
Yes, and most of them I'm moderating myself.
Wow. That's a lot.
Yeah, that's not insignificant.
That's, yeah.
That is a big number.
That's cool to hear, just because I kind of... For the way that others would tell it to us, the judge thing is sort of not as active as it used to be. But it sounds like it's, I mean, I don't think there was 100 when I was playing 6-7 years ago on the judges.
Yeah, I mean, well, it seems like it.
Well, back in the mid 90s, judges like USIN and USOS,
okay,
were running 400 or 500 games a year.
I used to play on USIN.
Yeah, I remember those, for sure.
We're just kind of looking at your website right now.
Yeah.
USAK.
Don't mind us, we're just surfing the web.
Well, I'm just curious. You said there was a web wrapper on it. That's not, you know. Yeah, no, there's quite a few games there to join.
Yeah. There's a lot of variants that are coded into the judges, too, is another thing that people who are listening to this might not know. If you've ever wanted to play a really weird variant, there's how many?
There's 60 now on USAK.
That's awesome.
So I just added 9 more very recently.
That's awesome. I remember playing a game of Chaos once on a judge, and it was really, really fun. The 34-player variant, they actually got one together.
I got that one together.
Yeah. You might have.
Yeah, I might have.
That was fun. I might have died in a one.
Didn't Silverman win that?
I don't know.
Anyway.
So that's going on. Let's back to the pouch a little bit.
Okay.
So I'm guessing we'll give you the free airtime to solicit writers and articles here, because I'm guessing that's something that's going on.
Oh, absolutely. I'm the December issue. I've got a theme, and that theme is the local hobby.
Okay.
Awesome.
So what kind of stuff? I've got an article from
Christopher Martin.
Nice.
And I've got a whole bunch of people that you haven't heard of before, who are running local games, who've had house games and whatnot, who are going to be writing from El Paso, from Atlanta area in Georgia, and other places, in Dayton, Ohio area.
Nice.
And these are face-to-face players in areas that you would never know that there was a hobby.
Yeah. Well, if you want a couple more of those, they email us all the time. I'll try and forward their emails on so you can plug them directly. That's a great theme, for one thing. I like that a lot.
What kind of stuff are you looking for? So if anybody's out there and they're just itching to get involved a little bit, what would be a good topic or, you know, topics to look for, write something about?
Oh, just about anything that is even remotely, vaguely diplomacy related.
Anything that's on your mind.
anything that's on your mind is somehow related to diplomacy. We have everything from the Larry Perry articles on what the diplomacy situation was with, for example, the Cuban Missile Crisis back in 1960.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Yes. Anything from that in the Strategy and Tactics article. Yep. We are absolutely starving presently.
And
nobody...
Oh, go ahead.
Nobody wants to write those because it's like painting a target on your back.
Yeah. Or say make a podcast about those for the same reason.
Yeah, there's some reason.
Yeah, I don't know. We lose now.
Hey, you podcast guy.
Yeah.
Stab. Break it off.
Yeah. I'm also just looking. I mentioned variants before, which is something we've almost never talked about on the show before. But the pouch has this giant library of variants. If you've ever wondered. Any of it, there's like hundreds of them on here. That's just another thing.
There's also there's a decent resource for finding face-to-face games. If anybody, you know, just major events are usually find their way onto the pouch. We try to add them. You can find stuff going on. And I remember there used to be all these games in Brazil and Africa and that kind of stuff. So that's another thing that the pouch is pretty good for. And I think just because, you know, the founding of it was really Manus Hand back in the early 90s putting this together, and people just sort of glommed onto it until it's pretty much become the biggest, at least most comprehensive, you know, sort of resource for diplomacy on the internet, on the web. So it's good stuff.
Manus used to write... like puzzles.
You can tell the story again.
The whole story, but
seriously,
there's some really fun, just like diplomacy brain teasers that he used to write. So everyone who's listening, if you haven't found all this stuff.
Oh. Sherlock Holmes Consulting Diplomat.
That's the one. Yep. Yeah.
So, and those are alive and well. He's doing those again.
He is.
Help of Mario Hyde.
Oh my God.
That's good.
That's awesome. Someone cancel everything for a month because the last time I got sucked into one of those, I just couldn't stop working on it. But anyway, pouch. What else about the pouch? Are we?
Well, no. I think we're kind of touched on some of the things I want to talk about. I just remember. You know, it has a big role for people, especially that are when they're just trying to connect into the community. And, you know, I'm really one of the reasons that it was great to get Chris on here is because that vibrancy seems to be coming back a little bit. And, you know, I'm excited to hear that we're going to go ahead and continue, engaging people in that way and to kind of get them into the community. Because it's really, this is how I got into it. This is really... Oh, you're looking at the Diplomacy Showcase? Dude, you like how it's my name on there that I'm supposed to be in charge of that?
Yeah,
you
I like just that? Found a little paragraph here that was like, if you have any questions about this, write nathan@diplom.org for Nathan Barnes, which I'll bet is an email address you don't check.
No, it's redacted to my web. Yeah, if you email about it, it gets to my inbox.
I'm totally going to email it right now.
Definitely email it, and you can check out the Diplomacy Showcase that's on there. I inherited that.
Yeah.
I designed a web interface for it. I gave it to Dave Norman, who said he's going to get right on implementing it because that's how he wanted to do it, and that was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Or 3 years ago, whatever it was. And he said...
Yeah,
and
David's great if you're on him. He's really good at doing things instantly if they need to be done instantly, and if you happen to be a really arrogant, pushy SOB like I am.
Yeah.
Own it.
But if you're willing to let it slide, he's willing to let it slide because he's pretty busy.
Yeah, David has already done like a lifetime full of work for this hobby. It's hard to stay too mad at him. So,
I'm not mad about it. I'm definitely saying I get to have my name at the bottom of this thing that I had nothing to do with that I tried to fix. And no.
Yeah.
Go ahead and check out some of these really good ones. You should. Just click on it. Go ahead. Yeah, so Eric's going to open up a really amazing animated GIF that really shows you what happened in the game
without any information
whatsoever.
Okay, so cool. There's one or two of them that work, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Anyway, Chris,
we digress.
Do you go to tournaments ever?
I tried to run one once. San Francisco tried. I managed to get an exhibition together at RandomCon in 2010, which was held over Mother's Day weekend. And I did manage to get seven players together for four game years.
That counts ish.
Yeah.
Probably
not exactly a tournament.
Yeah, not exactly a big impact on your Grand Prix standings, but you know.
Well, I would like to have a Grand Prix event in Phoenix by 2025. That's my big goal.
Nice. I'm rooting for you to do it by 2019.
Really?
Yeah.
That's pretty short.
I'm bidding it down.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, we're going to make this happen.
I don't have I really, like I said, I wanted to get this out here and just harp on it enough that anybody listening would at least type it into their web browser. So that's what I wanted to get Chris on the horn for.
We've long since accomplished that.
Right.
But,
what I'd like to accomplish is breaking down some of these silos.
That's the big thing.
You know, that's the big thing. There was a wiki war on the internet diplomacy, Wikipedia page that was really ugly for a while, and the Wikipedia page on internet diplomacy is still a shambles. There's citations on it that says there aren't enough secondary sources. So I'm making a regular column, getting one of the online sites each issue to have an article in there so that it can be cited as a secondary source in the Wikipedia article.
Is there stuff going on in internet diplomacy that we're not talking about enough on this show? I mean, I feel like I want to be able to direct people who are listening to the show to places where they can just get some games under their belt, even if they want to play from home, play on the internet, play real time, however they want to play. Where are the hot spots these days?
I'd like to think that one of the hot spots is USAK.
Yeah.
Well, there's 100 games going at once. I'm going to call that hot.
Yeah, that's like a year's worth of face-to-face diplomacy right there. So.
And what I like about that is the moderated games, and it's a real name culture, which means you use your real name in your registrations, just like Facebook, first name, last name. The actual place that you live, and that's a real good starting point to make a connection for face-to-face play.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now that said, web diplomacy, they've gone ahead, and despite their username culture, they've gone ahead and had some good face-to-face results from that. And that's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, I like that. Playdiplomacy.com, the joke is, how do you make a small fortune with an internet diplomacy server? Start with a larger one.
Oh, right.
Jen put $35,000 into that, and a couple years later, he made back $17,000 of it. He's since broken even, which is good. But when I started USAK, and when I first put it on the web and started asking users to support it in November of 2008, bookkeeping right away.
I'll see that, yeah.
So, then again, I wasn't paying for developers to turn an open source software into a commercial site. I was doing all the development myself and only asking the users to pay for the helmet with hosting.
Yeah.
Right.
But it should be emphasized that the average person just listening to this stuff can hop on there and just play a game for free, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
It's all free will donation.
Yeah.
So, and it will never be anything but free.
Yeah.
For those who want to play for free.
So do you think that there's just sort of a steady influx of kind of college-age people that are just still finding the hobby? Is it do you feel like we feel like in our tournament world that it kind of goes in cycles where there'll be a lot of people coming into it for a while and then sort of falling out of it, and sometimes there'll be lulls and then more people falling in? But do you feel like on the judges and other internet diplomacy, it's a little more steady trickle kind of thing?
Well, you get out of it what you put into it. So, what happens? You do have the college age players coming into it, and they play. And then things happen. They get married, they have kids.
Yeah.
They get jobs that take all their energy, and they leave the hobby for a little while, and then they get older.
Right.
And the kids grow up, and they're not so serious about getting ahead of their jobs anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then they come back to the hobby, and a lot of them just play, but some of them do things. And I was fortunate enough to be able to, or unfortunate enough to retire early. So, I mean, that's why I'm able to do all that I do. You know, and then you've got people, I mentioned Larry Perry before.
Yeah.
He's just retired.
Yeah.
And that's why after so many years, he's back writing for the hobby.
Yep.
And is doing so much now. I just talked him into volunteering to run for the Diplomacy World Cup Council.
I
didn't know there was such a thing.
Diplomacy World Cup was...
of course. No, we did. We talked Diplomacy World Cup with another one of our guests.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I know.
But there's
Sorry.
A council of it, apparently.
I didn't know there was a council.
For. I'm throwing my hat in the ring. I'm running for it, too. Yeah.
Yeah, there's eight people that are in charge of going over the bids and harassing the people who are willing to run this.
Gotcha.
And then after they after they're done and they stage the tournament, they're supposed to oversee the elections of their successors.
Goodness.
And what happened about a year ago is the Diplomacy World Cup ended, and we never got around to getting our successors elected.
Oh, okay.
So about 2 weeks ago, I was talking about this with Jim Burgess. And I had an idea before about a tournament format that I called Solo Derby. And I was talking about that with Jim, and I said, well, we should do the Diplomacy World Cup that way. And he says, that's a great idea, start writing it up. I said, well, I'm going to need some help on the I's and crossing the T's because I'm not the legal type. Well, it turns out I am the legal type, and Jim did help me dot the I's and cross the T's, but I came up with a proposal, and then we started looking over the charter for the Diplomacy World Cup, and we found out that we weren't the people who were supposed to be looking at it. We were supposed to be electing the successors first.
Oh, yeah.
So we're in the middle of, right now as this is being recorded, we're in the middle of the nomination process. And then around November 28th, we should be done with the election.
If people are interested in playing in it, roughly when do you think it's going to start, the new Diplomacy World Cup?
Depends on whether we get a rubber stamp on my bid or whether we go out looking for bids. It could be as early as January 2013.
Okay.
Oh, that's good. That's something to look forward to.
I got...
Now, the format that I'm proposing allows people to come in and enter at any time up until the end of the tournament. So, realistically, any time somebody listens to this up until 2015, really, because the qualifiers are going to take close to 2 years, they can go on Yahoo Groups and search for Diplomacy World Cup and come up with the Yahoo group. For it and find out from there where to go and apply for the qualifiers.
Excellent. Sounds good. I might actually play.
Hey, well, you were looking for an online game.
Yeah. Instead, I've just committed myself to 5 years of them or something, which is fine. Whatever.
It's good times.
Yeah.
It's good times.
I guess I want to kind of wrap it up with this. Do you think that, I'm kind of trying to tie it into the show that we've just done. Do you think that all of this online play evolves and as sort of generations of people cycle through the world of online play, do you think the tactics evolve? Do you think like more new ideas are coming out about diplomacy? Like we just did this whole thing about stalemate lines. Nobody's finding new stalemate lines because I think they've all been found. But do you think like more new strategic and tactical ideas are coming through, or do you think they're all sort of the same and they go in cycles? or neither?
No, I've heard some interesting stuff on the podcast.
Huh?
Mostly French openings, for example, especially when the judges are very conservative.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, not only France, but England usually stays out of the channel.
Mm-hmm.
The statistics in 2005 were that two-thirds of the time England does not go to the channel.
Yeah.
And I doubt that's changed. In my observations watching Dutch games, I don't think that England goes to the channel that much. And certainly Italy doesn't go to Piedmont that often.
Right.
Now, that said, I did play a couple games on Troy Dippy, and I do France a lot. And I got a lot of England in Italy that I did not like.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
But I think that Troy Dippy is a bunch of people. A lot of the people there are not diplomacy players per se. They are people who found the app in the App Store. Excuse me, Google Play.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Found the app on Google Play and read the rules and the link that was provided on the site. And, so you don't have the same tradition, if you will, Italy doesn't go to Piedmont because if he cooperates with the downfall of France, the only thing he gets is Marseille.
Yeah. Right.
So it's hardly worth compromising your Eastern game for one supply center.
Right. But
that's conventional wisdom on the judge player most places where people have been playing for 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
But you get a new form, and you have to discover the new lessons all over again.
Well, yeah.
And you hope that every once in a while they branch off in a new direction.
Well, that's what kind of makes the game fun is when we talked a little to this last episode about or this episode about how sometimes it's just the weakest person on the board that kind of describes how the board's going to go, and it's somehow sometimes the person who does the best is just the person who reacts the best.
There's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
Well, Chris, I really want to thank you for coming by and talking to a lot to us both about Pouch, which was our primary thing, but we really kind of got into some that siloing thing, and I think we've brought that issue up before, but I think you really highlighted it well for us. And if there's a way that our show can help bridge the gap between some of those silos, I think that's really an underlying goal that we have. So I'm glad that you came on and highlighted that for us.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, go ahead and stay tuned to the Pouch. Because like I said, I'm getting a different silo of online play on there each issue.
Good.
To try and get some exposure to different groups.
That's excellent.
Good, yeah.
We're going to keep in touch with it, I'm sure.
Keep us in the loop, for sure.
All right.
Thanks again for doing this.
Yeah, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Okay.
We'll talk to you soon.
You have been listening to Diplomacy Cast. Thanks, everyone, for joining us.
Wasn't it fun?
It was great.
I had a great time.
Yeah, definitely. For Nathan Barnes, I'm Eric Mead. Signing off. We'll talk to you next time.
For Eric Mead, I am a giant 13-foot-tall chocolate banana.
I was just trying to sound like a radio guy. That's what I get. Bye, everyone.